Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered community radio. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. On today's show, we move from the international to the national to the local. Bill Resnick continues his conversation with political scientist Stephen Zunis about Iran and its relations with the USA. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker share a Left and the Law segment about the role of district attorneys, including Kamala Harris. And Desiree Helligers hosts a roundtable on what's been happening at St. Francis Dining Hall in Southeast Portland with concerned long-term members of the St. Francis community, Joe Rastatter, Diana Schaffer, Albert Alter, and Melinda Pittman. You'll be able to find these segments and related links on our show page in a day or two. You can also visit that Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm to subscribe, to find links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or to contact us with questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. We turn now to Bill Resnick and Stephen Zunis.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Stephen Zunis. Stephen, welcome to KBOO again.
Good to be back.
Stephen Zunis writes, agitates, he teaches, he does scholarly work and op-ed pieces for Popular and Left Press. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, coordinates the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's editor of the journal Peace Review. He particularly knows the virtues of and many methods of nonviolent protest, building powerful nonviolent movements, nonviolent but still forceful. We talked last week about the U.S. attack on Iran and its possible consequences, that in fact this attack is spurring Iranian nationalism and support for the regime and actually helping the hardline forces in Iran. We talked about how Iran is a very complex society with all sorts of voices, to be sure. Let's now talk about why the U.S. is so hostile to Iran.
Well, I think, as I mentioned last week, there are many legitimate criticisms about the Iranian regime in both its domestic and foreign policy. Certainly, their U.S. allies, you know, such as Saudi Arabia, that have even worse records in these areas. So that's not the reason. The idea that Iran is an aggressor nation that is ready to invade its neighbors or anything like that's ludicrous. Iran hasn't engaged in a war of aggression for over 2.5 centuries. I think really what it comes down to is that the United States just doesn't like the fact that Iran is a regional power that does not give in to American hegemony. If you look back to the 2002 National Security Statement, the United States made very clear that not only would we resist the rise of a rival superpower such as China, we would challenge any kind of regional power that would threaten U.S. hegemony. It was what was known as full spectrum dominance. The problem is that Iran has been a regional power on and off for over 2,500 years. And they resent being treated like some kind of banana republic that the United States can pressure. They're not going to compromise with a gun at their head. So I think that really their big crime in the eyes of the United States is that it is not willing to follow its dictates in that part of the world. And, you know, therefore, there's this attitude that they are therefore a threat. They're not a threat to us in terms of our national security, but they are a threat to U.S. hegemony.
Yeah, and they're a threat to U.S. hegemony as it operates to privilege U.S. oil companies and the rest of the capitalist apparatus, our parts of the capitalist apparatus. We sort of won the great war of the 20th century, that is the control of Middle Eastern oil after World War II, the U.S. took over the Middle East. Iran really does threaten that because, in fact, Iran is that regional power that has allies in the Middle East. That is the despicable regime in Syria, but also Hezbollah in Lebanon, and then the military that was so capable, it forced Israel out of southern Lebanon when they were trying to sort of take it over in the same way they took over the Golan Heights in Syria. So it seems to me that there really is a threat to U.S. economic interests posed by the Iranians. And the Iranians, of course, have to support all these other movements to protect themselves, because if the whole Middle East turns against them, it seems to me it's extremely troublesome for them and they get weakened. They really are a threat, but they're a threat that we should support, not so much the Iranian state, but the Middle Eastern countries' control of their own resources. That's essential, in fact, to democratizing those countries before climate change, of course, wipes them all out.
Iran, you know, like Saudi Arabia and Israel, that are also regional powers, have certainly supported elements, including certain paramilitary groups that counter governments and movements that they oppose. And in the end, some of these groups are pretty nasty. Some of them have popular support and some less so. Hezbollah is an interesting example in that Hezbollah is a popular movement that represents the country's Shia Muslim population, which is the largest of the various ethno-sectarian groups in Lebanon, but of the three major ones, it's traditionally had the least power. It's traditionally the poorest of the three as well. And Hezbollah, which grew out of the 22-year Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, is a pretty reactionary group. I know a big fan of theirs, but they do have a lot of popular support, and Iranian support has been very critical and important to them at times. Though, actually, despite Iran giving them some financial support, they actually get most of their money from contributions from the Shia population, from taxation, because people there get a lot more from them in terms of social services than they do from the central Lebanese government. You mentioned Iraq, and of course, the overthrow of Saddam, who was a bulwark against the Iranians, you know, led to the election of the sectarian Shia parties, which have come to dominate the Iraqi governments in most of the years since the U.S. invasion and occupation. And these have been very formidable fighting forces. They've worked with the United States in fighting ISIS. They have been they've been accused of some war crimes in the process. Not nearly as much as ISIS, of course, but you know they've been ruthless at times. But they've worked with the U.S. essentially on the same side of fighting ISIS. But they play a role in Iraqi politics, again thanks to the U.S. invasion. Another allied group are the Houthis, which is a Zayedi group based in northern Yemen that succeeded in taking over much of the country when the U.S. undermined the pro-democracy movement there and installed a general who'd been the dictator's vice president, and things fell apart. But the reason I'm mentioning all these things is that the mainstream media, along with the Trump administration, keeps referring to these groups as Iranian proxies. And that's a dangerous word because proxy implies that they take orders directly from Tehran. And there's a difference between proxies and allies. And the reason that word, that distinction is important is that, let's say you Saudi Arabia bombs yet another Yemeni village in Houthi-controlled territory, and a local Houthi commander retaliates by lobbing a rocket into a Saudi airbase across the border. And let's say the Saudi airbase, like most Saudi airbases, has U.S. personnel there. And let's say this missile, this rocket ends up killing an American serviceman. You know, darn well, the Trump administration will say, Iran has attacked the United States. because the Houthis are supposedly proxies, and proxies do what they're ordered to do, even though in this case it would be just this individual Houthi commander. And that's what's dangerous about this kind of oversimplification, that we see these complex civil wars going on of various competing factions. And yes, you'll have Iran and Saudi Arabia and the United States and Qatar and sometimes Israel supporting, you know, various factions for their own benefit, but it's not like these groups wouldn't exist otherwise. I mean, you know, these are local conflicts with local issues, you know, some going back generations. But by oversimplifying it as, you know, us versus Iran, is really a formula that could get us into a war.
Yeah, and issues that are not just power issues, they're class issues. Most of the groups that are allied with Iran were the poorest and dominated by various elites, usually Sunni elites dominating a Shiite majority, like in Iraq, having a military supported by the U.S. and cooperating fully with U.S. oil companies. It seems to me these are also semi-class struggles in every one of these countries. And it seems to me sort of class struggles where you've got to side with the underdogs.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing that any of the regimes are particular models of democracy and decency, but in fact, they are more promising than the regimes, the kleptocratic and often some monarchies that are repressing them. Anyway, at least that's my hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. So the problem really is that there are popular class-based movements for justice, that they are often eclipsed because of all the guns. I mean, in Egypt, there have been scores of strikes that have involved many hundreds of thousands of Egyptians struggling for economic justice. But we don't hear about that in this country. We hear about some tiny armed Islamist group in the Sinai, or some other Islamic extremist group, and we miss the fact that most people in the Middle East are struggling for the same things that workers and other oppressed classes are struggling for elsewhere. I mean, one thing really striking about my time in Iran is I talked to an Iranian trade union activist who's been in and out of jail due to the repression of the regime. And he was pointing out how, you know, with the lifting of sanctions and the economy improving, and yet it not trickling down to the masses and the working class, it was empowering trade union activists to start challenging the regime's policies. Because the Iranian regime, like the U.S. government and a number of other places, you know, have used nationalism and conservative religious ideals to get working class support, even though their economic policies are against the interest of working people. But this guy is telling me about, hey, we're getting some momentum here, but by renewing the sanctions, the regime can blame all the economic problems on the sanctions and not on their misguided economic policies. And the threat of war has gotten people to rally around the flag, and it's made it easier for the regime to say that any kind of dissident group, including those who are working for labor rights, are therefore an American imperialist agent. And so, you know, U.S. policy is going a long way in hurting working class solidarity and hopes for social justice and democracy. I'd say not just in Iran, but in elsewhere in that part of the world as well.
Right. Yeah, although one thing about Iran is even though they imprison labor leaders, they rarely kill them, and that's really a difference. The Iranian, also the oil workers union, from time to time has been able even to strike and to make demands, and most of them are still alive. In Saudi Arabia, they're not allowed, and those people are just dispatched, right? That dissidence is just not even imaginable there in some of the other countries. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Stephen Zunis. We've been discussing the current struggle in the Middle East, the one that's most pressing and could lead to a general Middle Eastern war, or the annihilation of millions of people. It's not inconceivable. They're sort of on that path. And there are some who really do want to obliterate Iran, parts of the U.S. Trump administration. I think another reason that the U.S.'s elites and parts of the U.S. elites, but they're important and influential in foreign policy, have been humiliated by their defeats in the Middle East for the last 20 years since the attack on Iraq. It seems to me that those elites, though, like John Bolton, really have deep in their hearts a hatred of Iran because Iran basically humiliated them in the terms of their foreign policy choices. It seems to me part of the reason that the U.S. continues this sort of drumbeat and attack on Iran and their obsession with Iran is that these guys want revenge. Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and George Bush and John Bolton, who has power in the Trump regime, and Elliot Abrams, that whole crew of them, it seems to me, are really seen as fools. Mm-hmm. They're itching to do something about Iran. It seems to me it's really, that's an obsession for those guys.
Mm-hmm. They're frustrated. We don't live like the world was in 1950s when the United States could actually come up and, working with a few disgruntled elites, stage a coup and put in a government more to our own liking. And there's an incredible amount of frustration there, and they indeed want their revenge. The one thing that gives me a little bit of hope is I don't think Donald Trump is really one of them. The fact that he actually ran to the left of Hillary Clinton on foreign policy, that he disingenuously said that he opposed the Iraq war, while Clinton, of course, was a major supporter of it. And indeed, if you look at the counties that shifted most dramatically from Obama in 2008-2012 to Trump in 2016, they parallel almost exactly the counties with the largest casualty rates from the Iraq war. So Trump, you know, came into these places and saying, I will not send your sons and daughters overseas, America first. He fed into this growing isolationist sentiments you're seeing among white working class voters. And so he knows that he does get us into a war in Iran, it's not going to be popular, and it really is going to hurt his base, who will feel betrayed by this. Now, this doesn't mean that there isn't a risk for war when we're on a hair trigger type in a situation as we are now. The risk of a war starting is still very, very real. We still really need to mobilize on that. But I think that, you know, Trump himself is shares a degree of skepticism of the neoconservatives and their agenda. He just naively thinks he can bully the Iranians into compromise by making threats. And I don't think he necessarily wants to follow through with them. But again, it's a very, very high stakes game, and the risk of war is still very real.
You know, that also raises a problem. Yes, he doesn't want to become unpopular by killing a lot of America's unemployed young men from the Rust Belt, as his predecessors were perfectly ready to do. But he's going to take the Obama route, which is drones and air power. You don't lose many people in Nevada. You lose a few drones every now and then. It's only $500 million. What's the difference in our military budget?
Iran's going to be very different. This is not going to be just sending in some drones to take out some installations. It's going to require taking out command and control and anti-aircraft and other installations, and very likely at least some special forces on the ground, at least for short-term periods. You know, the fact is that people in the Pentagon do these war games. They see every scenario looks very, very bad for the United States and its interests. And the big hope I have right here is that there are a lot of people in the Pentagon right now, generals, admirals, others, who are telling the president, you know, we've run these war games. We see what's going to happen. This is not going to be good. Don't do it.
Steve, what's to be done by a peace movement in the United States?
Basically, I think we need to continue pressuring. I would like to see something like the Pledge of Resistance that we had on Central America, where tens of thousands of Americans pledged to do massive civil obedience if the U.S. actually invaded, to have some training for massive direct action that can serve as something of a deterrent. I think another thing is this greater education. We're blessed by having a large Iranian-American community, one which is actually highly educated and politically involved. I mean, it's diverse, and you do have a few of your Ahmad Chalabi wannabes and unrepentant monarchists and others, but most of them are like most Iranians. They don't like the regime, but they don't like U.S. policy either. They don't want war. And I think we can learn a lot from them, and we need to have them at our rallies and our teach-ins and whatever, sharing their perspectives and learning from them. But I think it's really important to mobilize the forces of the American peace movement and be sure to make it as diverse as possible in terms of class, race, ethnicity, etc. And I'm already seeing the beginnings of that, but we certainly need to do a lot more.
Steve Zunis, thanks a lot for talking to us. It's very informative. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. You as well.
So long.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
That was Black Sabbath with War Pigs. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Stephen Zunis about Iran and U.S. policies. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Later on today's show, we'll have Desiree Helligers talking with concerned long-term members of the St. Francis community about developments there. But now, we turn to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, to tell us about district attorneys.
In a closely watched race in Queens, Tiffany Caban has not yet conceded defeat in the race for the district attorney to her opponent, Melinda Kotz. In the recent recount, Caban was a mere 60 votes behind. And she adds on her website and online, this race is not over. Well, Mike, the left is finally taking on one of the deepest and darkest hearts of the criminal justice system. The district attorney races that have been challenged from the left all around the country. Let's start with the role of the DA and the office of the DA, which are the prosecutors in the criminal justice system. What do DAs and their offices do that's so important and makes these campaigns quite riveting and unexpected?
Well, they do everything. They are the beating heart of the whole system. 98% of all criminal charges are resolved by plea bargains. Trials are shows that happen occasionally, but the everyday business of crime and punishment has to do with the prosecutor accepting or rejecting deals. Misdemeanors are about 80% of a criminal docket, and prosecutors decide whether or not to incarcerate people. They do it all day, every day, everywhere.
And these aren't just rule-governed decisions that emerge out of the logic of the law, but there are political decisions at every point in the process. Can you say something about that?
Well, there are occasionally rules, like there was in Los Angeles County for a while, about when you could charge somebody with the death penalty. But basically, no, it's whatever individual DAs want to do. There are overall office policies within each prosecutorial office, but the prosecutors are on the line every day and at the top of the system. They are the most powerful people by far. Judges trail way behind in terms of influence over what actually happens.
Even though judges are often center stage and in public thinking and discourse about the criminal justice system.
And Trump is cramming the federal bench full of absolute reactionaries. But meanwhile, people are rising up all over the country. It's been remarkable to me. For example, in Missouri, in Ferguson, St. Louis County, Robert McCullough, the DA who refused to prosecute the cop who shot Michael Brown, was defeated by a black man, Wesley Bell. Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, he's in the teeth of the most racist police body in the country, and that's, you know, serious competition there. But Philadelphia, since Frank Rizzo, has got to be in the top. And the prosecutors are totally aligned with the cops there. And he managed to win by 75%.
So how much of these victories, though, are undercut by institutional forces arrayed against them? Because there's often, it's not, you know, the cowboy riding into town on the horse to save the day. I mean, there are enormous forces, even these progressive DAs that win on confronting mass incarceration. And like Tiffany Caban, her platform, including decriminalizing sex work, decriminalizing border crossing. She's very out as a Latina queer woman and has a very left-wing platform. But she, even if she squeaks by with this victory, what would she face when she came to work the next day?
Well, she would face strong opposition from the police, strong opposition from within her office. Like, what has happened is that Krasner fired dozens of prosecutors, some of whom promptly got work for the state attorney general's office. But there is opposition within the office itself, because
opposition to progressive change.
Yeah, has typically been the way to the top. The way you succeed politically is to be a prosecutor, from Earl Warren to now, over many, many decades. You prosecute as many people as you can, put them in prison for as long as possible, and when you do a really well-known case that gets you in the paper and gets you the kind of wide recognition from people in power that allows you to run for governor.
That's the political bread and butter for these folks that have greased the wheels of their campaigns, right? Lock them up.
And that's always been the style. It's always worked for years. And you work hand in glove with the cops, and the cops in a disputed testimony are always right. It's just how it happens. This has been caused tremendous upheaval in many offices, because that has caused, for example, what happened in St. Louis was that the prosecutors have sort of a union, one of these governmental unions. It's an association, but it functions effectively as a union. They joined the police union. So now it's despite the screaming conflict of interest. I mean, police are typically witnesses in cases. And a question on any prospective juror questionnaire is, would you treat the testimony of a policeman any differently than another citizen?
And the correct answer is no.
The correct answer is everybody's a human. You know, I'll see what I make of each of them as they appear. The truth is, these prosecutors are committed to always believing the police, even when they testify that the earth is flat. You know, it's an institutional requirement. And yet, so there's opposition, very staunch, very deep, very fierce, in every one of these offices. But the DA, so none of them have been able to do everything they wanted, but they've all done quite a bit. They've all, like, gotten rid of prosecutions for certain minor crimes. They've all lessened incarceration. They've all had profound effects on local everyday life.
Let's talk a little bit about California. The four progressive DAs lost campaigns there, but of course we have Kamala Harris, who is running as a presidential candidate, as a progressive DA, and on the face of it, it is striking and surprising that a DA would be running as a progressive Democrat, but how progressive is she?
Well, she's an opportunist, and that can be a good thing if it turns out that...
In what sense? Because all political campaigns are, to some extent, experiments in opportunity and exploiting opportunity. And in what sense is she an opportunist?
Well, I'd say in the sense that Bernie Sanders, like him or not, has been consistent for decades. He is who he is. He might seize opportunities in terms of presenting himself or whatever, but his ideas are pretty set. Kamala Harris will go with whatever's happening. I mean, I remember she was an attorney general for 4 years while I was doing death penalty work in California, and the fact that she was an attorney general meant absolutely nothing. The office prosecuted capital cases at the same rate and in the same way that they always have. She's never shown anything
to slow that down. She
right.
was not.
But on the other hand, she's responsive and she sees it. What happens is that these issues mobilize people. The real difference between the Republican in 2012 and 2016 was that the Republican vote was pretty constant, but the Democrats did not show up for Hillary Clinton as they had for Barack Obama. People show up in these DA races. They show up even in off years when voting percentages are typically down. They not only have liberals like the ACLU and George Soros moving in this direction, but minority communities all over the country are galvanized. Since Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, has focused attention on mass incarceration, the staggering disproportionate number of black people and brown people who are in prison.
And executed.
Yes, this issue resonates. And so she will not hesitate to go with this issue if she thinks it's going to help her. And she's
What else about her track record as a DA? Because she's presented herself as championing women victims of sexual assault and has some progressive credentials she pulls out to make the case for herself as a progressive DA, although that itself is very complicated in terms of how you use sex crimes as a progressive.
Well, yeah, she will seize upon moments here and there, but in truth, she defeated a really progressive guy, Terrence Hallinan, whose father used to defend the communist Harry Bridges against deportation, Vincent Hallinan. Terrence was K.O. Hallinan, a rough, brawling, left-wing Irish guy.
Oh, those people so easily forgotten and left behind. We'll have to return to him at some point.
I think he got bored by the job and wasn't doing much, and she's flashy. She presents herself very well. She hit the moment in San Francisco. But in terms of everyday reality, there was nothing striking, nothing really interesting, nothing remotely like what's going on in these DA campaigns in recent years. In Houston, which used to be death central for the whole country, now is famous for how many wrongful convictions they've reversed. They have a new DA, Kim Ogg, in Chicago. Everywhere else, people are doing striking things and interesting things, and she did none of that while she was DA.
Did she do any heavy lifting for these progressive DA campaigns around California? I don't recall her commenting on them.
Well, if anything, she stayed away. She steered very clear. I think she will have her nose to the wind, as always, and if it looks like there is success between these new coalitions and the mobilization of people who would be inclined to favor her, she might well come along, but she's not going to lead the way.
There was also an interesting case brought by the ACLU in New Orleans that's part of this same kind of surprising shift of suing a prosecutor. Can you, in our last minute or two, can you say anything about that case? Because it also involves DAs across the country being put on the defensive.
That's right. They're being sued for, in the New Orleans, they actually put out fake subpoenas in order to incarcerate crime victims to make sure they testify. And the prosecutors own the system to such an extent that they think all these witnesses can be put in their pockets and pulled out at a whim. And that practice is being attacked by the ACLU. Their failure to turn over exculpatory evidence is being attacked. They are being sued all over the country and often successfully.
So where is that case now in New Orleans? There can be a wake-up call, but that can mobilize pushback and defenses on the other side so that this is no cakewalk taking these prosecutors on.
It was just
they have a lot of experience prosecuting.
Right, it got lots of news, which is a good thing, but it's nowhere near resolution. So I guess I'd like to close by saying how widespread this is. There have been
And how important it is. And I think that in these dark times, it's important to acknowledge the rays of light that are part of our horizon in period two.
Well, it is true. It's in Dallas, San Antonio, five big cities in Texas, everywhere, all over the country. In Multnomah County, we'll have a chance in 2020 to elect a new DA. The old guy, Rob Underhill, is a classic prosecutor. He's been somewhat, he's more liberal than certain other ones, but he's steeped in the value system that has prevailed all over the country everywhere. And we'll see what happens in Portland in a year and a half.
Okay, so we'll continue to follow that locally and nationally. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the role of district attorneys and the movement around the country to elect progressive DAs. That is, of course, The Clash with I Fought the Law. And before that, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, The Left and the Law, with some words on district attorneys and why it is so hard to fight the law. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. And for our last segment today, we turn to Desiree Helligers and her guests from the St. Francis community.
Good morning. So my guests today are Joe Rastetter, who is a longtime parishioner at St. Francis, and he is the former dining hall director since the 1990s. He's also the former pastoral council member, and he's also with Jobs with Justice. He was the Faith Labor founder. He's a union organizer, justice organizer, and activist. And also with us here today are Diana Schaefer, who's a longtime parishioner at St. Francis, former St. Francis park director, artist, teacher, peace and justice activist. Also with us here today are Albert Alter, a longtime parishioner at St. Francis, a longtime volunteer of the dining hall at St. Francis. And also with us today are Melinda Pittman, who is a longtime activist, artist, musician, singer, songwriter, theater personality. So we're going to be talking today about the kind of unfolding backlash that's been going on at St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Church on 12th Avenue in Southeast Portland. There was an earlier segment last week in which Melinda was interviewed by Lisa Loving on the evening news. So we're going to post that interview as context to this one. And that was really talking more about the global context of this kind of right-wing backlash. And we're going to hone in on really the local implications and the long history of St. Francis as being kind of at the heart of the social justice, peace and justice community in Portland. So can we hear just a little bit about the history of the dining hall at St. Francis and kind of the critical services that it has long been providing?
Well, yes. St. Francis Dining Hall has been in the Buckman neighborhood. The parish itself is probably pushing 135 years, but the dining hall started with the Catholic worker community, and they served for about 10 years, and then St. Vincent de Paul ran the program for about 15 years. And then in the mid-90s, after our school at St. Francis closed, the park was being used by a lot of homeless, houseless guests living in the park, and many, many new people coming up from Central America and Mexico and stuff. And so so many people needing services that in 1995, I believe, the parish made the hard decision to not continue our relationship with St. Vincent de Paul, but to run the program ourselves. So since 1995, we've been taking care, St. Francis, of the community. And our hours expanded, too. St. Vincent de Paul was roughly an hour and a half, serving dinner from 4:30 to 6 or so in the evening. Well, when I actually was hired to be the first director of St. Francis, we expanded our hours originally from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. to meet the various needs that houseless people have.
And I would say also that at that time, there was more of a focused invitation from the community to make the dining hall, people who use the dining hall, to be members of the community. We didn't see any difference between the upstairs community and the downstairs community. We're all one.
Okay, and you also, for a very long time, ran a medical clinic out of the dining hall as well, up until just a few months ago. Is that right?
That's right. We had a long-term 16-year relationship with Multnomah County Health Division, and just within the last 3 or 4 months, that relationship has been severed, and all of those services, which included nurse practitioners, doctors, dentists, social workers, all of that has now stopped. And we believe that it's a money, who gets the money and who doesn't get the money, and the Archdiocese and it's CCHD, right, which is the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, who gives grants. So parishioners donate to the CCHD every year, and then that money is turned around to help service agencies and service works. So really, it is our donations that have funded the presence of Multnomah County, and now all of those services have stopped. So that means all the houseless community, and it's not only houseless, but low-income people, working poor people, people that are living in their cars and need some place to just be safe and to eat and have a cup of coffee and feel. Joe has a wonderful way of saying that. About
I'm not going to be able to follow you.
People suffering.
But I would make the point that one of the unfortunate likely scenarios is that the dining hall will be closed within a few months or years. But in the meantime, to cut back the services to just a dinner hour. And I want to make the point that to have a day services, which include mail and showers and lockers for people, even a corral for shopping carts to protect their stuff, is so important, partly because you're dealing with the shame and the discrimination that street people face. And so to have a place to hang out where they're safe is just so essential. Mm-hmm. And it's something that St. Francis has provided for many, many years.
And I mean, I think it's important also to talk about the fact that, you know, increasingly we've got data on the fact that people are literally dying homeless on the streets of Portland. So I think the last homeless death count showed that about 79 people are dying every year, basically, you know, outside on the streets of Portland. And those people are, you know, disproportionately people who are struggling with chronic health issues, with disabilities, and the average age of death of a chronically homeless person is about 47. So these are really life-threatening conditions, and you're providing critical services that are keeping people alive.
Right. And in that vein, the idea hasn't been tried for a while, but I know a few years ago, maybe 20 years ago, politicians took a shot if they were men and not shaving for a few days and then going and living on the streets for a couple of days. So I'd really challenge our new priest, Father George, and the Archbishop himself to not shave for a few days and to live on the streets and then see whether it's acceptable to cut the program to 1 or 2 hours or whether we should show up and have an all-encompassing services again throughout the day.
I just want to say I think that the Multnomah County covered the cost of the social worker and doctor, but that's been cut. And we again asking both the priest and the archdiocese, it's kind of hard to get a reason for why they are not coming now. Also, you talked about health dying on the streets. This is a place that's open from 10 a.m. in the morning to 7 p.m. at night, 6 days a week. You could, if it's 100 degrees outside, which it could be easily be in this time of year, or 0 degrees or below, we have a place they can come and stay. They can get a cup of coffee. We serve about 64 gallons of coffee a day. That's the size of the roller cart that you take to your sidewalk. Or that's also if you see a train car going down with a liquid train car that carries the bulk, that's the size of the coffee. We do about 90,000 meals a day. A year. It's a place to gather. We used to have a lot of people using the phone. How do you get a phone call? Now we do a service of charging your cell phones because a lot of homeless people or right. houseless right. people have cell phones, and that's they make a communication. They get mail there. They also can get showers and do their laundry. It's a full service. And do you need some medicine like aspirin? Do you need some glasses to read with to read that application?
Socks, underwear.
Yeah.
Clothing.
If It's more it's than just available. A meal service, and it's more than just a soup kitchen.
Yeah, like we said, I mean, it's providing important human contact right. and forms of support and dignity that a lot of they can't Correct. Find in a lot of other places.
And I think we also have to mention, along with that, forms of human dignity, just regular life as a human person. Diana was the park director for a couple of years, and we had, I'll let you talk to it, socials and things.
Well, we started this program because we had many houseless people who would just literally lay out in the park all day long, and it kept people from coming in. It didn't feel safe. So we
they're doing a sort of basic human necessity, right. which is sleeping when they don't have access to sleeping right. anywhere else.
And so we set up a program where we had activities for children. We had a regular walkthrough, talking to people, seeing what they needed, just kind of making sure that people from the outside would feel free coming in. So, and then once a week, we had a concert series. We invited groups to come in and play on an evening, and we had refreshments. So we were trying to create an atmosphere where the neighborhood felt free to come in and see what was going on, but also to provide a safe environment for the houseless as well as people in the neighborhood. And, you know, it was pretty successful. We had lots of groups come in and play, and they were amazed at what a beautiful little park it was. Yeah. And how generous the people of St. Francis were to the houseless and to the community as well.
Okay. And is it fair to say, too, that a lot of the community, the feeding that goes on at Sisters of the Road, that's on the other side of the bridge.
Correct.
So you all are a kind of critical anchor in this kind of lower
Correct.
Southeast region. And we're talking about people who are carrying oftentimes all their worldly possessions on their backs and who already have arthritis and any number of other disabling health conditions. So being able to stop here and rest is just absolutely critical to people's survival.
Right. I would comment that Sisters of the Road have been long allies with St. Francis. Mm-hmm. I remember in my days back in the 1990s when we had such an influx of many people. For a while, we took a program that St. Vincent de Paul had 175 people they would serve dinner to. It expanded to over 300, sometimes 350 people at the end of the month. And so Jenny Nelson and the good people there came over and helped teach us nonviolent training, how to get along, et cetera. And then the one other point I wanted to make is, unfortunately, have I heard of a model for Christian service, which was get them in, feed them, get them out. What kind of dinner program is that? I think at St. Francis, we really do aspire to learn people's names, to learn their stories, to develop relationships with people. Mm-hmm. And you know something? That's messy. It's difficult. It takes a lot of time. And you can't do that in an hour and a half a day. You need to open your hearts and your buildings for much longer hours.
And so just to be clear, we're not talking about an attack from the neighborhood association or from, you know, people in the neighborhood. We're talking about this attack coming directly from the Catholic Church itself. And I think that this little detail was an interesting one, that they've actually removed the name of Assisi from the website for the church, so that they're basically, the Catholic hierarchy seems to be rejecting the legacy of St. Francis of Assisi, who very much walked with the poor.
Well, I would say this began a year ago when our new priest came. And all of a sudden, the archdiocese was doing things that we had no knowledge of or did not even ask us what changes we'd like to see. Apparently, their concern was that our whatever we projected to the neighborhood in Southeast was not exactly about Southeast. It was about, well, what we wanted it to be, was mostly about the dining hall and our service and our
Social
legacy
justice.
At St. Francis.
Yeah. Yeah.
So because of that, things started changing, and we've never really had a reason given to us why what we project is not good enough, even though it had been for many years. I guess that's...
And so if we could ask the KABU audience, because this is not just a Catholic issue, obviously. This is an issue of social justice, and these are refugees on our doorstep, and we want to continue to open our doors to that. So the number for the Catholic Archdiocese and the Archbishop is Sample, and he is the one that's pulling the strings. He's the hierarchical head. His phone number, 503-234-5334. You'll have to go through a switchboard, but I would ask the KBOO listeners to please call the Archdiocese and try to talk to Alexander Sample, the Archbishop, and ask him why he is choosing to make so many people suffer through his desire to make this McDonald's Catholic Church out of the social justice, peace and justice calling that the people of St. Francis, all of our communities, are trying to respond to and continue to respond to as best we can. We sold our park, our beloved park, to make low-income housing. And so we as a St. Francis community are willing and called to be and accompany the poor. And so we need to ask the Archbishop why he's against that. Again, that number, Alexander Sample, 503-234-5334. Thanks for calling him.
Okay, and you recently also held a protest, didn't you, at the Archdiocese office?
We did. We had some picket signs out there. The one that I particularly enjoyed carrying was the Down with Misogyny, another manifestation of Archbishop Sample and our current priest is the assertion that women are demons, that we are born demonic. And yes.
What was the context for that statement? And where did it appear?
The priest has posted things like that on his Facebook, by the way. Yes, very right-wing stuff. And where it also came from was a community meeting where we demanded to talk to him. This was a year ago. Yeah. And he said there will never again be inclusive language at St. Francis.
Okay,
that was the beginning of that.
And we're talking about a parish that, for what, over 20 years had a female parish administrator, Val Chapman. So you really were at kind of the cutting edge of pushing the, you know, patriarchal structure of the Catholic Church.
And women involved in all levels of the pastoral council and liturgy and very, very well-studied and heartfelt people that have just been cut out.
Okay. And so, I mean, again, that question of why should people who are not Catholic care about this issue? I think in terms of the services that the dining hall provides, you made that great argument. Are there other reasons that people should care about this backlash and sort of attack on St. Francis?
Well, I think there are, because I think it's a political issue. Steve Bannon is one of the heads of the Catholic conservative movement and has that thinking, that kind of clericism and feudalism has inculcated the U.S. bishops especially. And so it's Diana
John Paul II and Pope Benedict.
Right. Were the two very conservative recent popes. And so there's Bannon's running a movement to try to get rid of Pope Francis. Because he's too much of a socialist.
Yes, you've really got that political struggle going on in the church globally, and this is a manifestation of it locally.
And the Catholics have money, and they are consolidating their conservative hierarchical position with their money and their holdings.
Okay, and just a heads up that both the Immigrants' Rights Day Labor Organization, they also are housed at St. Francis, so you should be thinking about that. So
They were housed at St. Francis. Okay, they have been thrown out from the St. Francis property.
Really?
Okay, is that a recent development? It sounds like not everybody's aware of it. When did that happen?
Well, I don't know that part.
All right, well, we're gonna have you back again on soon, we hope,
and do
a follow-up segment. Yes. So thank you so much to my guest today, longtime parishioners and volunteers at the St. Francis of Assisi Dining Hall on 12th Avenue. Yeah.
Thank you, Desiree.
Thank you,
KBOO.
Thank you very much.
That's Art Tatum with You Took Advantage of Me. And before that, Desiree Helligers and her guests from the St. Francis community. Thanks to Desiree and to Joe Rastatter, Diana Schaffer, Albert Alter, and Melinda Pittman. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Stephen Zunis for their discussion of Iran and U.S. policy. And thanks to Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for their Left and the Law segment on district attorneys. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering and to John Nielsen for editing. And to you, KBOO listeners and members. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host today. The Mole will be back next week with more news, views, reviews, and interviews from below the grassroots. You can, as always, find our show and its segments with informative links in a day or two on our show page at kboo.fm, where you can also find links to subscribe to the pod version, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and get in touch with your questions and comments.